Listen, I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Judges. We left off in chapter 13. And, you know, we because of the Christmas holiday, we weren't here for the last 2 weeks. So just keep in mind, when we're going through this book of Judges, especially for those who are here for the first time, who haven't been with us as we started this book, the book of Judges is basically a historical account of how the people of Israel continue to backslide, continue to slide back into their sins, into idolatry, into unfaithfulness, into ungodliness, into immorality. And every time that they would get to a certain point in backsliding and a certain point in their wickedness, God would just deliver them over to their enemies. And he would basically chastise them with one enemy after another. And then when the people finally came to their senses and turned to God and asked God for help, he asked God for deliverance, then God, in his own good timing, his own good way, would raise up a deliverer, and then he would deliver his people from their enemies. But I think it's pretty instructive for us when you read all of these examples that are given to us in this book of Judges of how there's that constant cycle where if we do forsake the Lord or get away from the Lord, very often he will discipline us to bring us back in line with his will. And that's what we see in this book of Judges. But tonight we're going to be reading about a historical figure, I think, that a lot of people have heard, this character named Samson. But you read this guy's life, this guy had really was amazing to me. In my opinion, few people in the Bible had more potential than Samson. If you look at his life, he really was enormously gifted. I mean, this guy really, I think, had the potential for greatness, incredible greatness. But you can see in reading this episode of what happens in his life that he got conquered by his flesh instead of using all the potential that God had given him for deliverance of God's people and for God's honor and glory. He just lived in a very selfish, self-centered way, and it was his absolute destruction and undoing, and I think he goes down in infamy in terms of his, well, not only his death, but his failure as God's deliverer. And I think in many respects, there's something to be gleaned from this guy's mistakes. Why all of us? Because in a sense, we all have the commission, in a sense, to be a deliverer in this respect. You know, we're living in a world that is flooded and gutted with people that are lost, that, you know, are on the way to hell. And we can deliver them from that fate if the Spirit of the Lord comes upon us and we're able to, you know, impart to them new life through Jesus Christ. But if we are conquered by our own flesh and living in sin, well, we're not going to be used of God. We're going to be set aside. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling here. But just what I think the best thing to do is to read this chapter 13 all the way through, even though it's 25 verses. If we read it all the way through, simply because the story flows, and then we'll go back and break it down. Verse 1, it says, "Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. And there was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had borne no children. Then the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, 'Behold, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now therefore be careful, do not drink wine or strong drink or eat any unclean thing. For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines.' Then the woman came and told her husband, saying, 'A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of an angel of God, very awesome. And I did not ask him where he came from, nor did he tell me his name. But he said to me, "Behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and now you shall not drink wine or strong drink or eat any unclean thing, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death." Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, "O Lord, please let the man of God whom thou hast sent come to us again, that he might teach us what to do for the boy who is to be born." And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of the Lord came again to the woman as she was sitting in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So the woman ran quickly and told her husband, "Behold, the man who came the other day has appeared to me." And then Manoah rose and followed his wife. And when he came to the man, he said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to the woman?" And he said, "I am." And Manoah said, "Now when your words come to pass, what shall be the boy's mode of life and his vocation?" So the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "Let the woman pay attention to all that is said. She should not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor drink wine, nor or strong drink, or eat any unclean thing, let her observe all that I command. Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please let us detain you so that we may prepare a kid for you. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to the Lord. For Manoah did not know that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name, so that when your words come to pass, we may honor you? But the angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing that it is wonderful? Or literally, it's not wonderful, it's incomprehensible. And verse 19, so Manoah took the kid with the grain offering and offered it on the rock to the Lord, and he performed wonders while Manoah and his wife looked on. For it came about when the flame went up from the altar towards heaven, that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. Now the angel of the Lord appeared no more to the Manoah or his wife. And Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. So Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die, for we have seen God. But his wife said to him, if the Lord had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have showed us all these things, nor would he have let us hear things like this at this time. Then the woman gave birth to a son, and she named him Samson. And the child grew up, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Manahem, Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol. Okay, before we go any further, I read that whole chapter through simply because I didn't want to break up this theme. But I think there's a lot of insightful things that can be gleaned from this episode. And, you know, just going back to that first one, and it says that the Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord again. All right, this is no less than probably the seventh time. I think Samson's like the 13th different judge. But again, you see this cycle with the backsliding and the unfaithfulness and falling back into the idolatry and mixing in with all kinds of pagan rituals and religions. And then God just gives them over to their enemies. And he gives them over to the hands of the Philistines. Now, the Philistines were the sworn enemies of Israel. And they... if you look at their history, I mean, the Philistines, we have modern-day Philistines today. I mean, you will never see a Philistine today because they've been wiped off the face of the earth. But when I say a modern-day Philistines, I'm talking about in a spiritual sense. And these people are all over the place as far as I'm concerned because these people are the God-haters. In my opinion, the ACLU is a bunch of God-hating Philistines. You know, they are just out to do everything they possibly can to strengthen the hands of the wicked and to oppose the righteous and to dethrone God. When you cut away all the smokescreen and all the claptrap about the, you know, the Constitution, you can see what's really at the heart of it. Well, you look at how many Philistines we've got to deal with today, and I would say like this, you know, spiritual Philistines today, they're making such inroads, okay, in this country and against God's people because there's so much sin in the camp. There's so much sin in the church. There's so much unfaithfulness. There's so much backsliding. There's so much apostasy that's going on that the Philistines are taking over. I know I'm making this mental leap here, but I can still see the connection, all right? Well, what happened here? God gives them over to their enemies for 40 years. They're oppressed for 40 years, and then they start crying out to God. So God's going to give them a deliverer, and it's very interesting the way he does it because he appears to this woman. This man is called Manoah. He's from the tribe of Dan, all right? And his wife is the one who's been barren, I guess, for many years. And then the angel of the Lord, who is the pre-incarnate Christ, because we, even from this context, we know he's talking to God. But she doesn't know it at first. She thinks this, first of all, she thinks it's a man or a prophet, but then she recognizes it's far more than a prophet, that it's an angel that's speaking to her. He tells her husband that, you know, basically an angel appeared to her and said that she was going to have a child. And Manoah doesn't laugh at his wife or mock her or ridicule her or, you know, even question the validity of what she says. I mean, he believes it. He just prays that he can, you know, see this angel for himself. For what purpose? So he can ask this angel questions as to how we're to raise the son. Now, here's what's kind of significant. It says the angel told the woman that he was going to be a Nazarite, that he was going to be dedicated from the womb. And I don't know if you can remember, we went through the book of Numbers. In the sixth chapter, there is the law of the Nazarite. It's the vow of the Nazarite. I won't read the whole chapter, I won't read the whole thing, but I think it's kind of significant because this is what God says in Numbers chapter 6. He says, and again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or woman makes a special vow, a vow of a Nazarite to dedicate himself to the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and strong drink, and he shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink, and neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat any fresh or dried grapes. He says, all the days till the separation he shall not eat anything that is produced by the grape, from the seeds even to the skin. And all the days of his vows of separation, no razor shall pass over his head, and he shall be holy until the days are fulfilled for which he has separated himself to the Lord. And he shall let the locks of his hair on his head grow long. And all the days of his separation to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead person. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother or for his brother or for his sister when they die because of his separation to God on his head. All the days of separation he is holy to the Lord. But if a man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his dedicated head of hair, then he shall shave his head on the day when he becomes clean, and he shall shave it on the seventh day, and then on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves and so on and so forth. Like I said, it's a long chapter. I don't want to go into it, but I just want to get you an overview of what this is all about. It boils down to this, okay? We've got to ask ourselves, well, what is he talking about when you make this vow as a Nazarite? It says a woman can make this vow as well as a man. And what this vow consisted of, you couldn't drink any wine, you couldn't drink any grape juice, you couldn't even have anything like raisins or grapes or anything that had to do with the production of wine or grapes, this type of thing. You got to ask yourself, well, what is this all about? Well, you got to go back to where it says in Galatians chapter 3 that the law was given to us as our tutor, as our instructor, okay, as our teacher. And what is it trying to teach us? It all points to Jesus, and we have to ask, what is it trying to tell us? Well, if you go back to Psalms, I think it's 104:15. Matter of fact, let me just read it, because in Psalm 104:15, he says, and he, God, causes the grass to grow for the cattle and the vegetation for the labor of man, so that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine which makes man's heart glad, so that he may make his face glisten with oil, and food which sustains man's heart. What this is referring to is this, that God has given wine for men to do what? To cheer men's hearts, okay? Now, I don't want to go down this road when people say, well, drinking alcoholic beverages is a sin, because I've heard even preachers say on the radio that Jesus Christ never turned water into wine, that it was not fermented, that it was grape juice. No, that to me is just being intellectually dishonest, because when I read in Psalm 104:15, it says that God has given wine to men to do what? To cheer men's hearts. Okay, now if a person goes out and gets rip-roaring drunk and smashed and intoxicated to the point where they don't know what they're doing, you know, that's a sin. That's overindulgence, and it's a sin. But God has given man wine what? To cheer one's heart so they can find joy in it. And this is why I think in the Nazarite vow, for whatever length of time their vow was to be fulfilled, they couldn't have wine. In other words, what it pointed to was this. Instead of trying to find joy in this world, and wine is basically one of the best things that the world can produce. Instead of trying to find your joy in the world, you know, a Nazarite would just set himself apart to find his joy in the Lord. Okay, we no longer are under this vow, but I'll tell you right now, spiritually speaking, this vow can still apply, and I'll give you an example. Okay, let's just say that you wanted to get yourself closer with the Lord. Let's say that you're not doing too well in your Christian walk. Well, one of the things that where we could find our joy in is, let's say, the TV. I mean, the last statistic I read, which is in Time Magazine, it's now up to 58 hours a week. It was 54, then it's 56. Now it's 58 hours a week that the average American watches TV. Now, you're going to tell me that they don't find their joy in the TV? Well, if you want to find your joy in the Lord, don't swear to God. You don't want to make any vows in that respect, because Jesus himself says, don't swear by heaven and earth, and let your yeses be yes and your noes be noes, because anything more than that is from the evil one. But I would recommend this. You want to get closer to the Lord? Make a Nazarite vow spiritually and just say, okay, I'm not going to watch TV for 2 weeks, you know, or even 10 days. And decide that, okay, all the time that I spend watching TV, I'm going to read God's Word. I'm going to spend this time in prayer. I'm going to spend this time trying to get closer to God. Now, Don't say, I swear to you, God, I'm going to sit down and read the Bible, you know, for 3 hours a night instead of watching TV 3 hours. Don't swear to God you're going to do any such thing, because the devil will get right involved and he will get you to break your vow. But what you want to do is you come to the Lord and say, Lord, I'd like to just pray that you would give me the good grace to do this, because I'd like to get closer to you. All right. So what are you doing? Instead of finding your joy in the world, which wine represents, you're finding your joy in the Lord. That's what this Nazarite vow was all about. And then it says that a Nazarite, a person making this vow, they were not to go near a dead person. Even if it was their mother, or their brother, or their sister, or their father, or whatever it is, if they took this vow, they couldn't touch a dead person. All right? And if they happened to be on a battlefield and somebody dropped dead next to them, or somebody dropped dead of a heart attack and they touched a dead person, they would be defiled. And guess what they'd have to do? They'd have to start their vow all over again. Let's just say they made this vow for 6 months, and 5 months into their vow, they accidentally touch a dead person. Okay, everything's nullified. They got to start all over again. They can't cut their hair. The hair is a symbol of strength. We see this in Samson. But also, it's this time where you show spiritual growth. Like all this time your hair is growing, it's pointing to your spiritual growth. Here's a situation. Let's just say that you, now understand something, you're not going to make a vow to God, but let's just say you have a real difficulty with gossip, or lying, or maybe stealing, or pick a sin, pick your poison, it doesn't matter. But you are determined that you are going to make a Nazarite vow, spiritually speaking, and say, Lord, I'm going to really try my best, okay, to refrain from gossiping, and with your grace, not steal again, not pilfer again, or not lie, or not do any of these things, all right? Well, let's just say 1 week into your determined vow, you know, you end up gossiping, you end up lying. Well, in a sense, you now defiled yourself, and you have to start all over again, because now sin is entered the picture, all right? Same thing with the Nazarite. This is what it pointed to. He'd have to cleanse himself, start his vow all over again, all right? And cut his hair and then let it grow all over again. Yeah.
I was just going to ask if he had to cut his hair.
Yeah, he had to cut his hair, start all over again. Okay, now, I didn't really want to go down that road as far as his vow was concerned, but, you know, when people read this about Samson, they're going to have some questions as to why couldn't he drink wine and why did his hair have to grow long. The hair was a symbol of his spiritual strength. All right, there were other Nazarites in the Bible. I mean, you look at Samuel. Samuel was dedicated to God by his mother Hannah. From his birth, he never cut his hair. John the Baptist was a type of a Nazarite. Jesus himself is referred to as being a Nazarene or a Nazarite in the scriptures. Okay, it's basically Nazarite means separated one. So they're separated from the world. They find their joy. They find their strength. They find everything in God. And it was Nehemiah who said, the joy of the Lord is your strength. So this is what Samson, you know, had to basically, it had to characterize his life. That his joy was in God. His strength was in the Lord. So what happened here was that, you know, this angel of the Lord appeared to both of them. And then I think it's kind of significant. The man, Manoah, wants to know some more details. Because when he did appear to him, he says in that verse 12, it says, and Manoah said, now when your words come to pass, so what shall be the boy's mode of life and his vocation? In other words, I think it says a lot in terms of what parents should do. In terms of, hey, looking to God in prayer for guidance, for direction as far as their children's vocations, for their careers, for their life's mates. I think it's, you know, something that they need to pray about constantly for their kids. You can glean that from this, what happens to this Manoah here as he's seeking God's face, what his will would be as far as his son Samson is concerned, or, you know, as far as his promised child is concerned. And one other thing, and I certainly don't want to go down this road either, because I've been down it so often on so many different occasions, but, you know, God promises this couple a child, all right, before he's even conceived, all right? Now, let's just say, you know, that they were living in our day and age, and then they decide, hey, man, you know, this is going to be too much of an inconvenience, and they decide to go down to the closest to the abortion mill and get rid of the child. I mean, you can't tell me that that's not a gross, flagrant sin in the eyes of God, I see, because this child was promised before he was even born. God had a purpose for him. He had a design for him. He had an intention for his life. And it's the same thing with every human being. And it could be cut short by people's selfishness and self-centeredness. Anyway, one last thing before we get into this chapter, the next chapter, I think it's kind of interesting that verse 18, he says, but the angel of the Lord said to him, well, back up to 17, it says, and Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name, so that when your words come to pass, we may honor you. You know, tell everybody what this angel's name was. And the angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing that it is wonderful? Does anybody's Bible say incomprehensible? Anybody's translation?
Because Beyond understanding.
Beyond understanding. That's what it really means, okay? Interesting thing. What does this remind you of in, I think it's chapter 19 of the book of Revelation? It says when Jesus Christ comes back, he says there's a name written upon him that only he knows. Remember that? When we went through chapter 19 of the book of Revelation, when he's coming back on a white horse, and he says there's a name written upon him that nobody knows the meaning of the name except him. Now, that to me is pretty darn significant, because if nobody knows the meaning of his name, what does that tell you about him? If nobody knows but him, then he's God. See what I'm saying? Okay. Nobody knows the name but him. That means he's God. You see, because God would obviously know his name. But he is God. It says that there's a name written upon him. And when it says here that his name is wonderful, it really means incomprehensible. It's like, it shows that he's infinite, that it's beyond a total, complete comprehension. When Moses asks God for his name, God said to Moses, tell the people that I am that I am. Now, that's not really a name, is it? You just tell them that I am that I am. What does that mean? When God told Moses, tell the people that I am that I am. I mean, is that incomprehensible? Well, this is what it means to me, is that I am totally self-sufficient. I am that I am. I rely upon nobody. I'm dependent upon nobody. I'm beyond everyone and everything. I am that I am. Totally self-contained, totally self-sufficient. See what I'm saying? That's what that name means. I am. Yeah. Yes.
When I asked my father what King of the Kings looks like, and he said he looked what he's supposed to look like.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Well, for those who don't know, Shum's father, when he was dying, he was in China, and Shum was led him to the Lord. And he was in a coma, and he came out of his coma, and he says, I have seen the King of the Kings. And Shum says to him, well, what did he look like? And he says, he looked like what he's supposed to look like. That's what he said. I mean, it's kind of like he's beyond description. You see what I'm saying? That's a good point. Anyway.
And he wasn't a Christian before that.
Right. Back up to that verse 19. And Manoah took the kid and the grain offering, and they offered it on the rock to the Lord, and he performed wonders while Manoah and his wife looked on. For it came about when the flame went up from the altar towards heaven that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. And Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces towards the ground, and the angel of the Lord appeared to them no more. And then look what Manoah says in verse, when he realizes it's the angel of the Lord, and he realizes that it's God. He says in verse 22, he says, and Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die, for we have seen God. All right. Every time you read about the angel of the Lord, it's the pre-incarnate Christ. All right, you know, because it always a context is to tell you it's God. Well, interesting thing, Manoah prepared this kid for, you know, the angel of the Lord, but he wasn't going to eat it. Instead, he said, place it on that rock there, and then the angel of the Lord took the staff, and the whole thing went up in flames, and then the angel went up in the flames with it. That this kid, this sacrifice, pointed to Jesus Christ, and the fact that he went up in the flames, I think was very relevant, showing that, you know, all those sacrifices pointed to him. They all pointed to him. In the Old Testament, every time they would offer up an animal sacrifice on the altar, or offer up a sin offering unto God, all right, the sin of bulls and rams and goats, they could never take away sin. But it was almost as though every single offering that was offered up unto God, it was like Jesus Christ was there standing at the right hand of his Father saying, I'm going to make that good. I'm going to make that good. I'm going to make that good. In other words, put it this way. What if you were totally, completely bankrupt and you were in desperate need of a huge loan to get yourself out of debt? But you had no collateral, you had bad credit, you were totally bankrupt, you had no way of getting credit. Well, no bank and no banker in his right mind is going to give you a dime, right? But let's just say you walk into the bank with Bill Gates, probably the richest man in the world, and you say, I would like a loan, and my friend here, Bill Gates, is going to co-sign for me. What do you think the bank's going to do? We'll lend you the money. See what I'm saying? Yeah. It's the same thing with us. All of these sacrifices pointed to Jesus Christ. And it was like Jesus would say to his father, I'm going to make that good. See? And, you know, even though we are morally bankrupt, we're not in a position to be able to save ourselves, he's the one who says, I'm going to make it good. And what's interesting, we read in Ezekiel, when they set up the new millennial temple, when Christ comes back and sets up his millennial temple, you know what they're going to do? They're going to reinstitute the animal sacrifices. And, man, and when I first became a Christian, I read all about that in chapters, I think it's around 44, in the book of Ezekiel, it talks about the new temple and the animal sacrifices. I wondered, well, why are they going to reinstitute the animal sacrifice? Then it dawned on me that during the millennial period, death is going to be virtually non-existent. All right? And so when people are living in a situation where they're not familiar with death, all these animal sacrifices that are going to be performed are going to be pointing back to the cross. All of them before Christ were pointing to the cross. Now, when Christ is ruling and reigning, it's going to be pointing back to the cross. All right? It's like you see a person's shadow. When the sun is a certain position in the sky, you can see a shadow in front of you. All right? And then as you keep walking in the position of the sun, as far as the earth is concerned, the angle of it is concerned, your shadow will go behind you. Well, that was the same type of thing. It all pointed to Jesus Christ, either pointing back to Christ or pointing forward to Christ as far as the animal sacrifices. But one last thing before we go on. Manoah, as soon as he realized that it was God, look what he says here. He blurts out and says in verse 22, so Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die, for we have seen God. Now, this is what I'm talking about. When people say, hey, I'm basically a good person. If there's a heaven, I'll go there. Well, you know what? Here's the thing. People don't realize it. We're all sinners. We're all sinful. We're not sinners because we sin. We sin because we're sinners. We're born sinners, all right? But we always are judging ourselves and comparing ourselves by ourselves, so we can always find people worse than ourselves to make us feel like we're quote-unquote good people, all right? But I'm telling you what. When you're in the presence of God, you know what your first reaction is going to be? It's just like it was with Isaiah in chapter 6, where he says, when he saw God lifted up, he saw a vision of God, he says, woe is me, for I am undone, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. In other words, when you're catapulted in the presence of God, the last thing in the world that you're going to say is, hey, I'm basically good. That's not going to come out of your mouth. You know, I guarantee you, it's not going to come out of your mouth. You're going to go, woe is me. I've had it. Because I am a sinful person. And you're going to want to find some crack, some crevice, some hole in this universe to crawl into and become non-existent because you're in the presence of an all-consuming fire of holiness. And you're going to realize, I'm not too good. Matter of fact, I'm a monster of iniquity. And I better get out of here quick. That's what you're going to instinctively feel. So it's a dead giveaway to me when people say, well, I'm basically good. If there's a heaven, I'll get there. You know, it tells me right away, you know what? You're so far from God, you don't see it. But here's the thing. The closer a person gets to God, guess what? The more they see themselves as a sinner. I mean, isn't this what happened with Noah? I mean, he was standing in the very presence of God, and we see him lifted up in the sacrifice. What is his first instinctive reaction? We shall surely die, for we have seen God. That's his reaction. He didn't turn to his wife and say, hey, wasn't that amazing? Isn't that incredible? Man, we must be really special to have him appear to us. No, it was where that realization hit them between the eyes. You know what? We just saw God. We shouldn't be living at this point. But his wife, you know, she says, well, put two and two together. She was a logical one. She says, hey, if he was going to kill us, he would have killed us. He says, he obviously, you know, has a purpose for us to be here. So, same thing. Does anybody have want to add or share to what we just read there? Okay. Let's pick up where we left off in chapter 14. It says, and Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. So he came back and told his father, his mother. It says, I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife. Then his father and his mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all of your people that you... go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she looks good to me. Now look at this guy here. Look at the number of times. This is the big difference between, I think, men and women. You know, Samson, he says, look at that in verse 1. He says, that he saw a woman, and she's one of the women of the Philistines. And then he says, he tells his parents, I want to marry this woman, get her for me as my wife. And what's his reason for wanting this woman as a wife? He says, get her for me because she looks good to me. I mean, men are visual, let's face it. I mean, they are. I mean, men are creeps, men are whatever you want to call them, but that's the way God made men. You know, it's important to man to have an attractive-looking spouse or attractive-looking, you know, girlfriend or whatever. Because why? Men are visual. I mean, let's face it, women too. I think most women would rather be beautiful than smart because they know that most men can see better than they can think, man. And that's just the way it is, right? That's the way it is. You know, he says, man, this woman looks great. She's a knockout. Get her for me. I want her for my wife. He knows nothing about her character. You know, nothing about this woman. He says, holy smoke, you look at her. Man, she's number 10. I got to have this woman. And purely based on her looks. And verse 4 says, however, his father and his mother did not know that it was the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. Now, this is kind of ambiguous because it says here that his parents didn't realize that this was the Lord. And so you wonder, well, did God sanction this? I don't think so. I don't think so. But I think what's happened here is there's two possibilities. First of all, the Spirit of the Lord began to stir Samson. All right? And he began to stir Samson. As a matter of fact, we read in the first chapter here, that verse 24 says, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him at Mahaneth Dan, between Zorah and Esdraeli. In other words, that was the military camp. Every time that Samson got by a military camp, the Spirit of the Lord would start stirring within him, and he'd really get the power of God would come upon him, and he'd really get this overwhelming desire to deliver his people from the Philistines. So when he sees this Philistine woman, there's a possibility that he figured, well, I can deliver my people from the Philistines by marrying into them. Now, that's a possibility, all right? But I get it's probably more likely the possibility that God just overrules his selfishness and self-centeredness and just feel like, okay, this is what you want to do, then I'll just use it as an occasion to smite the Philistine. For he says here in verse 5, it says, then Samson went down to Timnah with his father and his mother, and it came as far as the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came roaring towards him, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that he tore him as one tears a kid, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father nor his mother what he had done. So he went down and talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. Now, this is the third time we've told that she looks good. Right? This guy, that's all he sees about her. Not that this woman has a lot of class and she has a sweet disposition. Not that she's really a godly, spiritual woman. No, this woman's just a knockout. That's all he can see. In verse 8, and when he returned later to take her, he turned aside to look at the carcass of the lion, and behold, a swarm of bees and a honey were in the body of the lion. So he scraped the honey into his hands, and he went on eating as he went. And when he came to his father and his mother, he gave some to them, and they ate it. But he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey out of the body of the lion. Now, here's a couple of interesting things. All right, he's going down there to get this wife, to have this wife, and he's going down with his mother and father, I guess, for the wedding. And he's probably ahead of his mother and father, and they're probably behind. And then a lion comes out to attack him. And the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and he just takes this lion, I guess, by the mouth and just rips his mouth apart, just rips the whole lion apart, you know, with his bare hands. All right, nothing in his hand. Now, this is kind of significant to me, because in the Bible, Satan, Jesus Christ, the righteous, and the wicked are referred to as lions. And it's kind of interesting. Jesus Christ in the book of Revelation, I think it's chapter 5, is referred to as the Lion of Judah. All right? In Peter, we are told, be sober, be watchful, be on the alert, for your adversary, the devil, is roaming around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he can devour. And then we are told in Proverbs that the wicked flee when no one is pursuing them, but the righteous are as bold as lions. And then we are told, I think it's the 10th chapter and the 9th chapter of Psalms, the wicked are referred to as lions. All right? So you got to put everything in its context. In a spiritual sense, what's God trying to tell us here? That Satan is a lion. All right? He's seeking whom he can devour. That would be the context of this. He's coming at Samson. Samson is a man of God, but look what he does to this lion. See, when we are filled with the Spirit of God, and the devil comes at us, guess what? I mean, we really can resist them because the Bible says, resist the devil and he will flee from you, right? But here's the thing. Look what happens is that the devil, even if he's defeated, even if he comes to defeat, he'll always try to come back in some way, some shape, some form to try to do what? To try to attack us, to try to bring us down again. I mean, isn't that what happened to Jesus? You know, after 40 days and 40 nights when the devil ended up tempting him. And then it says, and the devil left him. And what did it say right after it said the devil left him?
For a season.
You know, the devil says, okay, he's won this round. But he's a diehard. He's perpetual motion. He's not going to give up. He's just going to come back when he gets a chance. So what's happened here? It says that he tore that line apart. But then, I guess a few days later, what happens is that there's a honeycomb that the bees have gone into the lion's mouth. Maybe it's a few days. I don't think it's a few months. But this decaying carcass is now got honey in it. But Samson's not supposed to touch this lion because it's dead. He will defile himself. But what happens? He sees the honey in there and he goes for it. He says, oh, heck with that. Nazarite, well, what the heck? This is honey, man. You know, and, you know, they didn't have sugar like we do in this in our day and age. So he scoops it out of the lion's mouth, but he doesn't tell his parents. What's the obvious reason? Yeah, he wasn't going to tell, well, I got out of this dead lion. They said, what? You weren't supposed to touch anything dead, right? Okay, the dead, it symbolizes what? When we read in the Nazarite vow, if he was to touch a dead person, he was to end up being defiled. Yeah.
Hanging around like spiritually dead.
Yeah. Well, where's the first mention of death in the Bible? Not Cain and Abel, huh? Right. God told Adam and Eve, hey, the day that you will disobey me, the day that you eat of this fruit, you shall surely die. Okay, we are told in James, it says, hey, you know, when lust is conceived, you know, it brings forth sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Lust, sin, death. So, in other words, this is what you can glean from this, is that even though Samson has all this potential for greatness, because he's so self-willed, he's conquered by his flesh. He should have never touched this dead animal. It was one thing to kill it, but then to touch it after it was dead, it defiled him. Same thing, you know, we can resist the devil, but he'll come back at us and he'll, you know, put honey on something to try to do what? To try to defile us, because he knows that, hey, the source of our strength is what? It's the joy of the Lord is your strength, all right? You find your strength in the Lord. Jesus said, stronger is he who is in you than he who is in the world. That's our strength is in Christ, right? But what will hinder that strength, just like it did Samson, if we continue to live in defilement? You know, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, but look at that, back up to that verse 9. So he scraped the honey into his hands and went on eating as he went. And when he came to his father and his mother, he gave some to them and they ate it, but they did not tell them that he had scraped it out of the body of the lion. Now, here's the thing. In essence, he's become defiled and now he's defiled his parents. And they don't even know it. Because if you go back to, I think it's the first chapter of the book of Haggai, it's interesting that God proposes a question. And he says, ask the priest for a ruling. He says, if you have holy meat, okay, something that's been dedicated to God, holy meat, and you wrap it up into your garment, in the fold of your garment, and then your garment touches some pot, some pan, some person, something, will the thing that you touch become holy? And the priest said, no. Right? Now, the next question was, now, if the priest touches, or if someone touches a dead person, then if what they touch, will that become defiled? And he says, yes. Here's a spiritual principle. God's given me good health, but I cannot impart my good health to anyone. As much as I would like to, I can't do it. All right? But if I had a sniffling, slobbering disease, and I was blowing my nose in a handkerchief, and then I threw my handkerchief over on the table, and somebody else came along, didn't realize it, and they picked up that handkerchief, they wiped their face with it. Guess what? They just become defiled by indirect contact. In other words, sin and godliness are highly contagious, and you can become defiled by things that are defiled, all right, even indirectly. Samson's parents became defiled, didn't even know it. But you can only become holy by direct contact with God. If your father is a minister, if he's a pastor, if your mother teaches Sunday school, guess what? That's not going to make you holy. You're only going to be made holy by direct contact with God yourself. Now, your parents can have tremendous influence in bringing you to that holiness, but it's only your direct contact, because God doesn't have any grandchildren. I didn't want to go, you know, get off on a tangent there, but you see the spiritual parallel, the spiritual examples that is being set forth here. So he says here in verse 10, he says, then his father went down to the woman, and Samson made a feast there, for the young man customarily did this. And it came about that when they saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. Now, this is speculative on my part, but it's kind of interesting. Samson, he goes down with his mother and father. It doesn't appear that he's bringing any relatives or any friends with him. And he goes down there, and they find 30 companions for him among the Philistines to celebrate this wedding. What's kind of significant to me is, why wouldn't he have any friends with him? Just kind of speculative on my part.
You're not supposed to
marry. Yeah, because he's marrying a heathen woman, so that his friends, his relatives say, we're not going to that wedding, you know. So he's just going off, doing his own thing. And so they bring in 30 friends, 30 companions to make him feel good. So here he is. And then he says in verse 12, he says, then Samson said to them, let me now propound a riddle to you. If you will indeed tell it to me within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. But if you are unable to tell me, then you shall give me 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. And they said to him, propound your riddle that we may hear it. So he said to them, out of the eater came forth something to eat, and out of the strong came forth something sweet. But they could not tell the riddle in 3 days. Now, here's the riddle. I think it's kind of significant, okay? Okay, first of all, you kind of get the picture of what's going on there. They didn't have a lot of the, I don't think, a lot of the type of, obviously, the entertainment that we have today at weddings and whatnot, okay? So one of the things that they would do is they would tell jokes, propound riddles, do this type of thing for entertainment. So he proposes a riddle to them. And his riddle is kind of significant. He says, out of the eater came forth something to eat, and out of the strong came forth something sweet. Now, for the Christian, who did this lion represent? The lion represented Satan, because Samson is spirit-filled, right? This is the lion that Peter talked about. Your adversary, the devil, is roaming about as a lion seeking whom he can devour. All right? Remember what when Peter said that? He said it in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. All right, that our adversary is like a roaring lion. Well, this is, I think, the spiritual application here, is that this lion represented Satan. And Samson, being spirit-filled, just tore him apart. All right? Samson would never have been able to do that in the flesh. Never, never, never in a million years. Samson would have been devoured in the flesh. All right, it has to be in the Spirit of God. Otherwise, we are destined for defeat. There's no getting around it. But now, get this picture straight. The lion represents the devil. All right? Read this riddle again, and you tell me the significance of it. Out of the eater came forth something to eat, and out of the strong came forth something sweet.
This is the lion.
The lion, out of the eater. The eater is the lion. The lion is who? Satan. All right? Now, I'm talking spiritually now. I'm making the spiritual application, because the Bible says again and again and again that all Scripture is given to us for our reproof, for our edification, for our example, for our instruction. This is what it's given to us for. So we got to ask, okay, what is this trying to teach us? Is this just useless information about something that took place thousands of years ago and has absolutely no relevance for us today? No, I don't believe that for one split second. I think it all has tremendous relevance for us. Well, we have to look at it with spiritual eyes. Otherwise, we're not going to comprehend what it's saying. So if this is the devil, what does this riddle mean? Out of the eater came forth something to eat. This is my take on it. Remember when Joshua and Caleb and the 10 other spies came back from spying out the land of Canaan? They came down, and 10 of the 12 spies gave a bad report. But Caleb said to the people, look, don't worry about these people. They're giants, but guess what? They'll be food for us. Remember when he said that? What did he mean when he said that these giants will be food for us?
When they win the spiritual victory, and that will make them strong.
Right. In other words, when we confront these people, we put our faith, we put our trust in God, and then when we are victorious, we will grow in our faith. They will become food for us. See, make the same spiritual application when you read this. Out of the eater, the devil is going around seeking whom he could devour, right? He's the eater. Came forth something to eat. In other words, hey, God could just bind Satan and throw him into hell and never, we never have to deal with him. All right? But God, for one of his reasons, he has an infinite number of reasons, I'm sure, but one of them is that, hey, when we confront the devil, it will strengthen our faith. Our faith will grow when we obey God and resist him. That shows faith, doesn't it? And so what happens? Out of the eater comes forth something to eat, that he will be food for us in the terms that we will be able to grow. It's not a situation where you can use the fleshly means to defeat him. You always have to be in the spirit. And with our fallen nature, it is very difficult doing battle with him. Because he knows our weaknesses, he knows our frailties, he knows our frame, he knows our hearts, he knows all this stuff. And he knows how to goad us, he knows how to get us. He knows how to attack us where we're most vulnerable. So it's not an easy thing. But if we put our faith in God, we trust in Jesus Christ, we resist the devil, what happens? We grow. We grow in our faith. So he says, out of the eater came forth something to eat, and out of the strong came forth something to sweet. I mean, Jesus said, stronger is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And read this here. And out of the strong came forth something sweet. All right? Well, if Jesus is in us, he's the one who says, hey, you know, learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart. And then he said, hey, come to me, all ye who are burdened and heavy laden, for I will give you rest, because my yoke is sweet and my burden is light. Remember when Jesus said that? Well, it says, out of the strong came forth something sweet. When we get into that yoke with Christ to resist the devil, you know, I mean, it is sweet. It is sweet in this respect, that when we connect with God on that level where we're supposed to be connecting with God, you know, we find our joy, we find our peace, we find our contentment in life. In spite of our circumstances, in spite of our situations, there's nothing in the world that can replace that. It's a sweetness. I've had some of my richest encounters with God in some of my most difficult times when I've just seek him in prayer, seek him in solitude, get along with him in prayer. Even if my heart is wrenching or breaking or hemorrhaging or, you know, I'm going through all kinds of trials, you touch God and it's really sweet. It really is. And then he says, well, that latter part of verse 14, it says, and out of the strong came forth something sweet, but they could not tell the riddle in 3 days. All right, here's the thing. We're never going to be able, in my opinion, to see spiritual things with fleshly eyes. We're not. He says these guys didn't know the answer to this riddle, you know, in 3 days into the wedding feast, which was 7 days. All right? And that's the same thing. This book, you know, we're told in Corinthians that the things of God are foolishness to the natural mind. You know what that means? I mean, he said, we're not going to be able to comprehend them. How many things that we read in the scriptures that we will not comprehend, all right, if you just look at it with fleshly eyes? You know, how about that guy who was, gathering firewood on a Sabbath, and then he was stoned to death? Well, our fleshly eyes look at that and say, hey, this is wrong. God is just a big bully, that this is a total miscarriage of justice. You see what I'm saying? But, wait a minute, you're just looking at it with the eyes of the flesh. Stand back and look at it with the eyes of the spirit, and what do you see? The man broke the Sabbath, but what was the Sabbath pointing to? It was pointing to the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross, when he said, it is finished. Therefore, what was the message to us? The message is this. If any of us try to get to heaven by, quote-unquote, being good or doing good works or doing a good deed for the year, whatever else you want to come up with, guess what? The end result is going to be eternal death. See, that's looking at things with the eyes of the Spirit. But if you're only going to look at it from the eyes of the flesh, you're never going to see it. You're never going to answer this riddle. You're never going to be able to understand it. You're never going to be able to comprehend it and never be able to unfold the mystery. We always have to look at what's being said in the Bible with eyes of the Spirit. Otherwise, it makes no sense to us. Right? So these guys couldn't figure out the riddle in 3 days. So now what do they do? Look at that verse 15. And it came about on the fourth day that they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband that he might tell us the riddle, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us to impoverish us? Is this not so? And Samson's wife wept before him and said, you only hate me and you do not love me. You have propounded a riddle to the sons of my people and have not told it to me. And he said to her, behold, I have not told it to my father or my mother. So should I tell you? However, she wept before him 7 days while their feast lasted. Now, get this guy.
Sounds like a good time.
Oh, geez, it gives me a headache just thinking about this. You know, 7 days in a honeymoon or whatever, she's crying the whole time. Verse 17 says, However, she wept before him 7 days while their feast lasted. And it came about on the seventh day that he told her because she pressed him so hard. She then told the riddle to the sons of her people. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day, before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion? And he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. Now, this is very instructive, okay? Because you see what happens to Samson. He's conquered by his flesh. But how is he conquered? He's conquered by women. I mean, we're going to be reading other episodes where he's just going to fall into sin and be undone by his flesh, by his weakness for women. And I'm telling you, that is a man's weakness. It really is. A woman has tremendous power over a man. And this is what happens here to this guy. All right, she wears him down. What happens? She tells his enemies. And so now he's in a situation where he's just fed up. And so what does he do? It says here in verse 19, then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ascalon. And Ascalon is one of the Philistine cities. And he killed 30 of them and took their spoils and gave the changes of clothes to those who he told the riddle. And his anger burned, and he went up to his father's house. But Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his friend. Now, we're going to have to end this tonight because, you know, we just don't have enough time to go through this. I really wanted to go through the entire episode of, you know, Samson, but there's no way we can do it and give it justice. But in this closing verses of this chapter 14, it says the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. What did he do? He goes down to a Philistine city. He kills 30 Philistines, strips them of their clothes, comes back and, well, I guess throws the clothes into these guys' faces because he said to them, hey, you'd never gotten this riddle if you hadn't plowed with my heifer, all right, if you hadn't kept pressing my wife to tell you the riddle. Or so he gets into the clothes, and then he goes storming off in a huff. He's mad at her, all right? And his father-in-law figures, well, you know, so much for that. So he ends up giving his daughter to, I guess, Samson's best man. Could read that verse 20. It says, but Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his friend. In other words, I think the father-in-law said, well, we got a wedding feast going here. I might as well make use of it. So he says, he's off. Well, I want you to marry her. So, you know, he gives his wife away. All right. Now it's just going to basically set the stage for now a real confrontation with the Philistines. But then again, you can read the situation like what he did in Ascalon, going down there, killing 30 Philistines. You read it with the fleshly eyes, you say, well, this isn't right. Well, put it this way, okay? I really believe that Samson was just a loose cannon. He really was. He, you know, if he was really seeking God's face and seeking God's direction, all right, God could have used him mightily. Samson probably could have got together an army of men and said, look, we're going to break the yoke of God's enemies and our enemies. And just gone out there and led a whole army and just wiped out the Philistines, and that would have been the end of it. But instead, he's off just doing his own thing. But God's still using him. But I don't really believe that he's going in the direction that God really wants him to go. All right, but he's still using him. See, this is the thing. Remember Balaam? God spoke to Balaam through the mouth of a jackass. So God can use anyone. He can use me. People call me jackass all the time. He can use me to speak his word through. All right? But he can use Samson to accomplish, you know, his ends. But you see, here's the thing. I really believe that Samson was missing, you know, the best because he wasn't seeking God. Now, when Samson went down and killed 30 Philistines, sure, it was, you know, to pay a debt. But what God was doing, he was using Samson to judge the Philistines. Why? Philistines were wicked people. And he was dealing with them. But like I said, when we get further on, we read the next two chapters, especially about Samson, we can see that the guy, he just is not in tune with what God would have him do. But God uses him anyway. But in the end, I think he comes to, I think, an ignominious end or defeat in his life because he's so conquered by his weaknesses rather than obeying God, following God, seeking God's face, seeking God's direction. I think it has a real solid message for us today. You know, as far as, hey, if we're going to be effective in this war against God's enemies, and I'm talking about the spiritual forces of wickedness, what do we really need? I mean, we really need to be obedient to God. Otherwise, if we're going to live in sin, then the devil can take us down and God's enemies can overrun us. Anybody have anyone to add or share? Yeah.
What happened to Samson's parents is that they defiled honey.
They weren't told that, but I'm just simply saying that they, you know, were defiled by that through that indirect contact. But there is a law in the books, if you read it, I think it's in the book of Numbers, where there's a special sacrifice that is offered unto God for people who sin against God unintentionally, not even knowing it. And believe it or not, the sacrifice that was required, I think, was a female goat. And almost all the time, the sacrifice would be a male. Well, for a trespass that was unintentional, it wasn't done, you know, with a high hand, it wasn't done intentionally, you just didn't know, it did it out of ignorance or whatever, then God required a female goat as a sin offering. Why a female goat instead of a male goat? What? Why is a female goat worth less than a male goat?
Because it can't die.
Because what?
It takes like one
to... Right, that's it. It's reproductive powers. In other words, hey, you can have a whole flock of female goats. All you need is one male goat. And guess what? You're going to have a lot of offspring out there. That's why with an unintentional sin, all right, sin, people that sin unknowingly, unwittingly, and then they found out that they, let's say they found out they were defiled, they found out later, well, then that would be the required sacrifice. It wouldn't be as hefty as a ram or a goat or a bull or, you know, that type of thing. Anyway, I really wanted to go through more than what we read tonight, but, you know, I think we're just not going to do it justice if we try to get through the whole thing. So we'll go ahead and close the prayer. Lord, we just thank you for the opportunity to read your word tonight. I really pray that what we read won't go in one ear and out the other over our heads. I think we're reading about an episode in Israel's history that revolves around a man that had enormous potential. In my opinion, he probably had the greatest potential of virtually anyone in the Old Testament for greatness. And I think that the warning, the message, I think is pretty clear. I mean, I really do believe that we really do need to live lives that are obedience to you. Otherwise, we're just going to end up under the pile. We're going to end up defeated in our Christian walk with you. So we just pray for the good grace that we need to remain faithful to you, true to you, to obedient to you, and do things your way rather than our own self-will. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.